Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
Yeah, good evening to a second installment of the Tech Show interviews. Or is this third, Pat?
This is actually, well, we had the pregame episode.
Right.
And then yesterday we had the interview with Miguel.
Okay. And actually, these interviews actually took place yesterday, too.
Yes, most of them.
And the first one up, we have the infamous Black Ratchet
from BinRev Radio.
Just stopped by, so we talked to him for a few minutes.
All right. We're with Black Ratchet from BinRev. Black Ratchet, props, man. Thanks for coming down and saying hello.
I gotta say, that's a pretty interesting recorder there.
This is an iAudio. Less than $100, man.
Really?
Yep. It's great. Plays AUX, MP3s. Good stuff, man.
I'll have to check that out. What's the storage on it?
What is it? This one's 512. The gig one's a little more. I think 140. So you guys are having fun here or what?
Actually, it's just me here today. I'm the only Boston representative.
We talk about technology.
Trom's out in L.A. and everyone else is, BinRev is out in various places. I think I'm the only person, closest person is Not Theory in New York.
So how'd you hook up with the guys from BinRev?
Actually, about 2 years ago, I was very bored at my job and had nothing to do, so I started downloading podcasts, one of which was the Linux Link Tech Show. And I started listening to Default Radio, and they kept on talking about, BinRev. So I'm like, okay, I'll go check these out. Normally, I don't hang out on forums, so I just went and said, okay, I'll probably stay here for about a week and get sick of it. And I started hanging out there, and a week turned into a month, and a month turned into a couple months, and they needed someone to do a couple of tasks, so I said, I can do that. And they said, hey, would you like to come on and actually be part of the cool people group? And I said, okay. And somehow I got sort of short straw and had to do the radio show after Stank left. So
why did Stank leave?
Well, Stank didn't leave. He just publicly unplugged. He was he had a lot of things coming up in his real life, as everyone can understand, and he's still on the forums and he still hangs out, but he's not as the public figurehead anymore. So, I mean, he's there, he's behind the scenes, he still runs the server, still is on the forums, and he's active in the moderating group, but he didn't actually publicly post too much. He's starting to do it a little more because his private life kind of settled down, he had everything back in order, but he's still taking a very backseat.
That's cool. You still keep in touch with him.
Oh, yeah. He still keeps in touch. We all know each other. And if we have a private forum that we all go on and we all, chit-chat and everything. And we're all just talking about what's coming up with Hoop 6. So.
Well, we're all listeners of BinRev, and we appreciate you guys put us on, man.
I'm glad you guys listen.
You guys do a fantastic job, and you should keep it up, man.
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing it. Every 9:30 Tuesday night on GDP Hack Radio.
People, check it out, man.
GDPHackRadio.org.
Good stuff. Thanks, Black Ratchet.
Hey, thanks a lot.
For our second interview, a guy showed up at our booth with a really interesting project called GameX, and his name is Eli Tomlinson.
From Scranton, PA.
From Scranton, PA. And the audio on this one, it may be a little hard to hear. I mean, he's pretty clear, but there's a lot of background noise.
A lot of people around.
Yeah, so we apologize, and you're going to hear that with, I think, the first interview we did and the next one after this. So, it's still valuable information you can't get anywhere else. So here's Eli Tomlinson.
This is great.
Okay, we're recording.
That's pretty high tech. I like that.
Yeah. We're all about the high tech.
Alrighty, we're with Eli Tomlinson from GameX.
Correct.
Grand Pennsylvania. Just give us a little description of what you guys are doing.
What we're trying to do is create an open standard for a PC gaming platform.
I like it.
And really, most of the interest we've gotten from developers is on the Linux platform. GameX is a hardware specification for an open gaming platform. The real concept behind it is that the PC entertainment market has been declining. And obviously PlayStation, Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft have been doing phenomenal with the consoles. But Linux is the perfect platform to make a PC as easy, as reliable, as simple as the consoles. So the idea is to drive software development towards live CDs that boot your games.
So you're going to do a live CD distro with certain games pre-installed?
Correct. And each CD boots the game. We have two of them here, Neverball and Supertux. Supertux, I believe, is 100% full working. Neverball works except they have a bug in there. Save replays that we're fixing. I've got three more games that I think are going to be done before the end of April. They're all pre-existing Linux games. We don't have a lot of new development. But what we have been going to quite a few developers. We're just out at the Game Developers Conference in San Jose. I've gone to a bunch of sessions of the North Jersey chapter of the National Game Developers Association. What we're finding is on the game development side, everyone is very, very open and embraces the idea. Everyone likes the idea. So I don't think we have a lot of problem getting software developed for the platform, but really to make the concept work, what we really need to focus on is getting hardware manufacturers to certify the platform and publishers to start actually putting that out into retail.
So that's the hurdle right there. So, I mean, because we keep hearing time and again that Linux is not the gaming platform. People would love to have more games on Linux, but, you know, Windows is the way to go. But you're saying, it sounds like what you're saying is...
How can you say Linux isn't a gaming platform? What do you think the PlayStation Portable is?
Well, right. I agree with
preach
you
it to the choir. We know.
And the thing is that Linux is a great development platform.
Right.
When it comes to gaming, what matters is the hardware. And what you have is you have a lot of issues with operating systems like Windows not being really ideal for the gaming platform, but Linux is ideal for the gaming platform.
Uh-huh.
The idea that you can do live CDs, that as far as a user is concerned, it's a simple platform, again, like a PlayStation or like a Xbox.
So, it's not the developers. It's the end market right now. You need to get that hardware manufacturer to buy in.
Correct.
Support, and because we're going to start seeing more and more.
Because they really drive the awareness of anything that you're trying to promote. The original awareness tends to come from the hardware manufacturers.
I don't.
And like I said, we were worried that the hardest part was going to get software developers to sign on board. But like I said, by end of April, I'll have five games. Everybody I've talked to has been very open about the idea. The only resistance we've gotten is skepticism. Because it's such a big idea. Really, to make it really successful on a big scale, you do need to convince the large hardware manufacturers, the large software developers. But you know, so much back-end game development is happening on Linux.
Right.
The 3D modeling. I mean, it's almost like they build games in Linux and then have the port keys to make them work under Windows because they don't see a Linux game market. But we're saying you don't need a Linux game market. All you need is a PC game market because now with the idea of the live distributions, as long as you can make it work with that environment, again, you're turning the PC into a video game console.
Yeah. That's really nice. When, do you have a Blob Wars disc yet?
No.
No.
But again, you know, anything, any ideas or suggestions, on the we haven't really pushed developers a lot because we don't want to get discouraged that a market doesn't exist yet. And at the same time, everyone that we talk to says, oh yeah, we want to do something. So really, for me, the pressure I'm feeling is, again, getting the hardware buy-in. I'm going to Computex in Taipei in June. I have a bunch of meetings lined up, you know, hoping that we'll get GameX logos on some of the ASUS motherboards or some of the Gigabyte motherboards. But I think it's going to really take that because then the developers will see that there's
interest.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Seems like that's the biggest thing. You know, most people either want to do PC gaming, you know, with Windows,
yeah.
Or they want to do console-based. And most of the consoles are based on Linux to begin
with. Correct. The thing is with PC gaming is, again, the PC is the best platform as far as the power of the hardware and the flexibility of the hardware. Some of it is that I don't really know what you want to know or what you're interested in, you know?
Yeah, what's your website?
It's GameX.org. Actually, you can go GameX.com, GameX.net.
GAMIX, right?
Correct.
Thank you. And we'll check it out, man. We'll definitely have you on again.
Great.
Take care.
Have a great show.
Thanks, Eli.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Eli. I'll be
sending you an email, right?
Yeah, because again, anyone who you want or you want to tell to email me, I'll send them the discs, I'll send them whatever information
they want. Yeah, I'll put you on, you know, maybe both shows will put you on. Okay. Talk about different things. Yeah, there's a lot of interest. A
lot of areas of cover.
A lot of people we talk about.
Well, you know what it is, again, developers want to do it, but they want it, there has to be a market. You know, I was a big fan of, and I'm going to try to think of, who is the first publisher who was trying to push the Linux game?
Oh, Loki?
Loki. Yeah.
And it was just there's a company in Britain that does it now, too.
Are
you familiar with them? What's the name of that? The British company.
What, the one that does Darwinia?
Yeah, Darwinia.
Yeah, they do... just a couple small companies out there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah.
For our final interview today, we lucked out that Pat was able to stop Bruce Perens and ask him if he'd like to come in and sit down. Pat, how'd you get Bruce?
I saw Bruce walking around the floor, and I saw him on a cell phone, and I kind of, like, followed him around a little bit, but I wasn't too obvious, hopefully. He's really busy on the phone, so once he finally got off the phone, I went up to him, and he was so kind enough to come over and talk to us for about half an hour. He's a great, great, great interview. Bruce Perens is a really smart guy. He knows a lot of stuff, and he brought up some really good topics about patents as well as accessibility.
Yeah, so enjoy. And again, apologize for the amount of noise in the background, but that's the way it goes at these things.
Hi, this is Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show, and we're here at the Linux World Expo in Boston, and we have a very, very honored guest here. We have Bruce Perens. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's a real big honor to have him actually talk to you. It really is. I've actually tried to contact you a couple times.
And you know, it's funny. I have a public phone number. It's even on my website. Now, if you call it, you won't always get me. And I leave it off the phone, off the hook when I don't want to be bothered. But a lot of the time, you can just dial that number and Bruce Perens will answer.
Oh, really? And,
you know, I don't hang up on people.
Do you read your emails?
I read my emails. I don't necessarily answer everyone. And sometimes it's because I don't feel I need to. Sometimes it's just because I'm busy and I forget. So if someone is trying to contact me, you can try more than once.
Well, welcome to the show. We finally got a hold of you.
Thank you.
What are you doing these days?
Well, I am vice president for Source Labs, which is different from most vice president positions in a company because I am paid to be an open source leader half the time, and Source Labs does not influence what I do in that capacity. I just choose my own agenda. And the other half of the time, I am running professional services and policy for Source Labs and being a spokesperson for the company.
You must get a lot of requests to do interviews and talks.
Actually, one of the things I'm most interested in is keynote speeches. And I actually have to find someone to go out and push keynote speeches for me. But that's a problem, too, because there are lots of events that'll say, can you come and speak in Singapore? And if I go speak in Singapore, that means it's a week that I'm not with my six-year-old. And he'll be disappointed. And, of course, I want to be a good parent.
Understandable. I have a two-year-old.
Yeah. So I do have to balance that kind of thing. You know, some people, Richard Stallman is the greatest example, have given their entire lives to free software. I don't. I have a life. And I also work on free software.
Right.
And that actually, I think, gives me more perspective in some cases, because you may remember that I used to be pretty famous for being a hothead. And when I became a parent, that actually wasn't as big a deal because free software was no longer the most important thing in my life, and I could view it with more perspective.
Absolutely. So you still do development these days, or...?
It's interesting. I'm doing software development right now, and I took a professional services contract for Source Labs with a Wall Street firm and decided to do the software myself. And that's because, number one, I'm an architect, and it's important to keep my hand in, and I felt this was a place where I could make a contribution. And number two, I don't want to only do policy for open source and never be a coder, because that would take me away from the open source developers who I am trying to represent. So I feel it's important to program. Also, if you go on technocrat.net, which is a weblog, actually it's supposed to be a more mature version of Slashdot for grown-ups. I wrote all of the software for technocrat.net in Ruby on Rails. It's not released as open source yet, but one of the modules, which is called Model Security, which is a security policy software for Ruby on Rails, is already released as open source.
But what are your thoughts on the current state of where web development has gone?
Web 2.0 is problematical for a number of reasons. First of all, let's think about the blind people in the world, the physically handicapped people in the world. Web 2.0 is a blind man's misery. And when we had standards-compliant HTML as our presentation vehicle, we had some hope of giving a presentation that could be made accessible for a handicapped person. When your whole system is running on JavaScript and doesn't gracefully degrade when the JavaScript is turned off, which indeed I think is the most useful option for a blind person, is just turn that stuff off. If your system doesn't degrade gracefully to pure standards compliant HTML, you're not being very sympathetic with the handicapped people who might have to access your site. Now, you can get away with that if you are a small business under 50 people in the United States. But if you are a larger business or a government agency or something that's publicly funded, you actually have ADA requirements. Americans with Disability Act in the United States or similar legislation in Europe, similar legislation in many parts of the world. And my theory is that a good deal of Web 2.0, unless somebody takes the time to do the engineering, is not ADA compliant. I don't feel the screen readers are adequate presentation for a lot of people who can't see it. That's really the only thing that wouldn't work for a Web 2.0 interface. You know, speech wouldn't work, or if we're really lucky, someone's done a whole speech style sheet for their website. But that's hard to do for a sighted person, and I've never actually seen a website that comes along with a speech style sheet for blind people to use.
Excuse me. You bring up some really good points there. And I work for a school district, and I work on the web page and design for that. And I've been trying to make it not only standards compliant, but accessibility compliant. And that's tough, because I have some suggestions that I've read that say, you know, look at it in a text-only reader. You know, make sure it's standards compliant, but I don't have a screen reader or any other device that would mimic or what a person with disabilities would use. So, I mean, how do you recommend, how do people go about doing that? And with Web 2.0 coming out and those technologies, it's going to become more of a problem to be able to ensure compliance.
Okay, so let's see if we can fix this with technology and free software. We have all the pieces of a web screen reader in free software. I've not seen them integrated. We have an absolutely wonderful speech synthesizer in FastBox. And that's the major component. The other component is just something that gets the HTML down. We've sure got a lot of that. So I'm surprised that I'm not seeing more of that software, and also I think it should be a component of major distributions, because it's our responsibility to make our sites accessible. Now, okay, so let's get by the accessibility issue. Look at the total mess of APIs that we have to program Web 2.0, where we've got server-side Java, or in my case, server-side Ruby on Rails, running client-side JavaScript, wedging everything that it does into the document object model of the browser, there seem to be a great many APIs, and from a software development standpoint, maybe this isn't productive as it could be. Now, David Hennemeyer Hansen, who is the developer, main developer, there are a number in their community, but he's the main developer of Ruby on Rails, has put in all of these Ruby facilities that actually generate JavaScript. And, you know, maybe putting a layer on top of it is one way to do it, but, I don't want to learn yet another language to do web programming. I'm afraid most people have already bit the JavaScript bullet, and I do a little, too.
So then what are you looking for then? What's your preferred environment or API for writing?
Well, I am absolutely blown away with the ease of use that Ruby on Rails has presented. And I've written some reasonably major things, and I'm doing commercial work for real customers. Although it's actually not a website, it has a web interface in it. And I'm using Ruby on Rails for that, and Ruby indeed for the entire project. And that's going on Wall Street. So I'm really impressed by it. I have tried a whole bunch of web development environments. I'm not primarily a web programmer, but remember I spent 12 years at Pixar and I know computer graphic presentation. I actually did not go to programming school. I went to communication arts school and I learned how to direct professional talent and make movies and advertising and journalism. So web development for me has usually been kind of painful, and I think most people have been willing to live with the pain. But I remember in 1981 when I first started using Unix that this whole pipes and filters and shell thing that Unix did was to me at that time a very natural paradigm. And remember, I was a communication arts student. I hadn't taken computer courses and it still worked for me. I learned to program on a couple different platforms by then. But shell and pipes and filters and Unix just flowed off my fingers when I wanted to write software. And I have never had that feeling again about software until Ruby on Rails came along. And at that time, web development just flowed off my fingers when I thought about it in a very painless and easy way. And so I think that David and his colleagues have done some wonderful work there, and there's no going back.
Great stuff. So what do you think of the current state of Linux? I mean, you see all this here. But it, you know, would you imagine that it would have grown as fast as it has?
If you had asked me when I started working on Linux and open source, which I think we're going back to the Linux 0.9.6 days, and actually Electric Fence was my first open source program, and that came out in 1987. If you had asked me way back then, would there be a trade show for it? Would every company on Wall Street be using it? Would the United States government, the NSA, and the Department of Defense be heavy users of it? I would have said, you're on drugs. And, you know, that makes me wonder, have I just been living this incredible wish fulfillment drug dream? You know, it's solipsism is the word for that. And, you know, when Eric Raymond and I did this open source thing to promote Richard Stallman's idea of free software and business, we had no idea what people would just grab that up and that open source would just be on everybody's lips the way it is. Now, in retrospect, indeed, there are some things I would have done about that differently. But, you know, I didn't plan on being blown away by my own success. Having the problems that come with that kind of success, like, oh, 70 different open source languages, licenses, 70 licenses that aren't compatible with each other. You know, when I wrote the open source definition, I didn't think that would happen. Also involving Eric was probably a good mistake.
We'll let him know.
Yeah, okay.
Now, as intimate as you are with open source, what do you see happening from this point on with the development of open source?
Well, let's not get complacent.
What is your dream of what's going to happen, like all of our dreams? But, like, realistically, in the not-so-distant future, what kind of things do you see happening?
Let's not get complacent. I think we still have some very big problems, mostly to do with the law, secondarily to do with things that are sort of peripherally the law, like digital rights management. We are in deep doo-doo regarding software patenting, and not everyone understands that, but I think if Microsoft or some other companies really wanted to, they could shut down open source development in a week. And they could
What do you think is stopping them? The bad PR?
Well, there are a couple things. One is antitrust, which they've never really gotten off the hook, fortunately, and I shiver about the day when they fully get it off the hook. The second is, I don't think that any big patent holder is going to aggressively enforce their software patents until they get the software patent laws that they want in Europe, because if they did enforce them now, they'd just be making bad news for the laws that they want. So we've had a reprieve, and at least in United States patent law, that's a really important reprieve, because there's something called the doctrine of latches, which means that if you wait for the market to develop instead of asserting your patent when you become aware of the infringement, that is a defense that the defendant can use to get off an infringement charge on your patent. And the standard interval for a latches defense is 6 years. Cases have been won for as little as 1 year, and, you know, sometimes it's taken a longer time. However, it's only defense. It's not an affirmative law that says if no one asserts their patent for 6 years, you get to use it scot-free. You still have to go to court. So the American Intellectual Property Law Association, the actual organization of patent, trademark, and copyright lawyers, has a financial and economic report that they issue every year. And that report says that it costs $3 to $5 million to either assert or defend a patent case. Now, I can tell you exactly what will happen if some company brings a patent case against Dan Washko. Okay, so if they bring it...
They're coming after you, Dan.
Okay, first of all, and do you work on any open source software?
I don't do development.
Oh, okay. But if Dan was an open source developer and he had his copyright and his name on some software, and some company went and said, oh, you're infringing our patents and you've got all kinds of damages and go get a lawyer and meet us in court, Dan would first have to approach all of the sugar daddies in the open source world, which are OSDL, Red Hat, IBM, Hewlett Packard, etc., and say, oh, please help me get my butt out of trouble here. Now, it happened that I had a guy bring a suit against me with much less foundation than the software patent suit, and I went and asked companies for help, and I got a thanks but no thanks from Novell, from a number of others. So do not
And fortunately, I had other reasons to reconsider. But do not assume that any sugar daddy is going to come to your defense. Now, OSDL and Red Hat both have funds, but those funds are very limited. They can only cover a couple cases, and there's no guarantee that they will even use that money for you. They might decide to use it for another case. And if you look at OSDL's board of directors, those guys are all very heavy software patent holders, except for the one holdout who represents the kernel developers. And their interest is more in protecting software patents from open source than protecting open source from software patents. So OSDL, much as it tries to do good things, can't really help us in this regard. They can only take half measures because of the interests of their own board. So the legal situation is bad. Now, what's the next problem besides software patents?
Ask you a question about that.
Yeah.
In your opinion, is the legal situation, is it if it'll ever happen, or is it a when it's going to happen type of scenario?
Well, when I worked for Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft briefed Hewlett-Packard on Microsoft's impending effort to bring suits against a number of open source projects. That never happened. The memo actually became public about 2 years later. And, imagine what it's like as an open source evangelist working for a company and knowing that Microsoft has briefed the company on how they're going to sue your friends and not being able to do anything about that. I told Source Labs when I went to work for Source Labs, if you ever find out information like this, just make sure that I'm not there. Because there was no ethical path for me. You know, my first loyalty was to the open source community. HP knew that, and I had an NDA. So what's the ethical path there? You either break your agreement or you screw over your friends. I won't tell you which path I took. So anyway, Microsoft did bring that suit. What happened behind the scenes? We have not the slightest idea. We may never know. And if you ask Microsoft, they're not going to tell you. If you ask IBM, what are you doing to defend open source? Well, you know, we have this patent quality thing that OSDL would patent on this. I described that at the last Linux World as spitting in the wind. I've since actually participated in the effort, and it's still spitting in the wind. It's not going to make changes as substantive as we need. I still thank OSDL and the Patent Office for giving me the opportunity to have my say. So we need patent reform for a number of reasons. Unfortunately, not all of them have to do with free software, because software patents are actually bad for the whole economy. And
stifles innovation.
Well, you know, when you say stifles innovation, it's a very fuzzy thing. Let's elaborate a little. 80% of companies in software are what we would call SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. All of those companies are going to be at peril of the top 20% who are the big patent holders, who will always have a larger portfolio than the SMEs. And what you get actually is a sort of pyramid scheme where everybody is paying up to IBM more than they get in royalties from IBM. So the problem here is, as a small company making proprietary software, potentially you have toll gates in doing everything that IBM does not have. They can execute on developing software where patents are infringed because they have cross-licenses with all of the bigger patent holders, and you can't have that. You're too small. The problem is that top 20 don't represent a big enough piece of the economy for them to get that kind of power. We should arrange things so that the larger part of the economy, the 80% of companies, are the ones that can execute on software, as well as the 20%, and that means we have a need for software patent reform. Okay, so we have some chance of selling this, but it's going to be a hard and violent fight. One of the reasons is we are up against the creator of the software patent problem, IBM. IBM? But they're our big friend. Not in this, they're not. I've certainly sat across a table at standards committee meetings and elsewhere from IBM where they've been pushing the software patent. And I've been trying to defend open source. So,
Do you see a white knight if a patent war came about?
Not yet. There's not one I can really point to. I have my hopes. And one of them, frankly, is Department of Defense, but obviously DOD is very constrained.
They're big into BSD, the Department of Defense, because it's a little... The licensing for BSD is, you know, take what you want and give nothing back, pretty much.
No, actually, that's the wrong way to do it. DOD uses all kinds of free software, BSD or otherwise. The reason that you're thinking of BSD licensing in this connection is because ARPA sponsored the work at Berkeley. And ARPA sponsored that work with your money as U.S. taxpayers. And the people at Berkeley and or ARPA felt that, hey, you've paid for it. You deserve to be able to use the technology for anything you want. And that is a case where I think BSD licensing is fair. But within U.S. government, lots and lots of GPL software gets used. And I just came from the SE Linux program, where SE Linux is GPL software developed by the ultimate spook agency, the NSA. So I don't think you can say that U.S. government is very BSD licensing centric.
Fair enough.
What about, do you think we're going to get any help because of the situation that they have with the European software patents? The influence
that... Oh, yeah. So we just had to beat down European software patenting, and now we have to do it all over again. And they're just going to come back every year, I'm sure, until they can get what they want. It's a really sad situation. And I hope we'll win again this year. You know, it means I have to go to Europe a lot. And thank goodness that FSF Europe is becoming more active and grooming some real leaders. And that, you know, I don't have to do the whole job. I never really did, but I had to do a lot. So I'm very glad that we have good people fighting.
You're going to mention the second reason of wider adoption of open source prevents wider adoption of open source. You were going with patents. You were just about ready to go with the second one before I asked you more questions.
Oh, yeah. So about other legal hurdles or semi-legal hurdles, the second one is digital rights management. The problem is that pervasive deployment of DRM could make Linux and open source an uncommunicating island. No one will have a reason to use it that way. Now, if we get DRM on lots of web servers, for example, because a lot of people who offer web servers don't want you to use print screen. They don't want you to use view source, certainly not. And they don't necessarily want you to be able to print the page at all, because, hey, that's evidence. Or they don't want you to print the page without paying them something extra. They need to be quarter if you want to print the page. So that could drive pervasive deployment of DRM in web browsers, as obviously Microsoft makes it a part of IE and Vista. And that could, for example, kill Firefox and kill, as far as I'm concerned, the entire concept of an open web, which the U.S. government is out to do anyway.
You really think so?
Well, they're kind of poo-pooing net neutrality. Net neutrality is very important. If you consider, what do people vote from? They vote from information that they get in the media. Now, it used to be that only rich people could own the media. If we go back to the day when the printed page was king, it was only the rich people who could have printing presses for a newspaper, or copyists, if you go back before the printing press. Now, the printing press was actually the most democratizing innovation that there has ever been, because we got to a point where most people could afford at least a small printing press. And then anyone could distribute a handbill, it wasn't a whole newspaper, with democratic discourse. And that could be used to influence the voters. And then we went to an era where television and radio were the way that voters were informed. And for a time, we had the fairness doctrine enforced by the FCC in the United States, which meant that broadcasters had to air differing viewpoints. That has been struck down. Broadcasters need not air any viewpoint except that of the rich people who own the broadcast station. So then we got the web. The web is like the Gutenberg printing press for electronic media, because it makes it possible for Anish Lamiel to have a television station, a radio station, and a newspaper. And now, with the imposition of a tiered internet structure and differing quality of service, where you've gotten a kickback from the content provider, and in fact you don't have responsibility to air all contact providers at all, get a cell phone. Use the web browser on most cell phones and you will find that they have their own partitioned web that's separate from the internet. So this means that because both FCC and the people who spoke out about it in Congress have poo-pooed net neutrality, they're sort of expecting the economy to solve the problem. I don't think it necessarily will, that we might go back to the pre-Gutenberg era or the TV and radio station era, where only rich people could distribute democratic doctrine, that would democratic discourse, discussion, that would influence the voters. And that, I think, is profoundly undemocratizing.
We're not there yet.
I think net neutrality is a critical element in the future of democracy. Now, at the same time, your internet provider didn't necessarily set up its price structure for you to have streaming TV and streaming telephone and everything else. And I think that your internet provider has a right to charge you for the quality of service necessary for streaming TV or streaming telephone service, but they don't have a right to discriminate against providers. If they charge for better quality of service, it has to be a charge that goes to the web customer, not to the content vendor, and it has to be equal for all content vendors. Because that's the only way that we will enfranchise the nonprofits who have something to say about politics, etc.
Bruce, you've given us a lot to think about. There's a lot of issues that we need to tackle, discuss. I thank you for spending the time to talk to us, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
Sure, call me anytime.
Thank you.
And we're going to wrap up today's offerings with a dinner with Jeremy Garcia.
From LindysQuestions.org.
That's right. After the show, we all went out. We'll travel around Boston for about an hour trying to find Jeremy's hotel. And afterwards, we managed to get a parking spot and had some good food and good drinks at an Irish pub.
And Dan didn't come home that night.
A story for another time.
But they spent so much time saying XP is the best.
Well, right, but
now they have to convince you, like, nah, XP is.
But what defines the success of XP? I mean,
number of installed desktops.
But over what period of time?
It's life.
Its entire life? But I mean, but then how do you define the success of? I mean, when do you determine that XP is a success? Or when would you determine that Vista is a success? I mean, they already have the app right out of the gate. You go buy a computer when Vista's released, you're going to get Vista.
Right.
So out of the gate. But
in that sense, it's a success the day before it's launched.
Yeah. Right.
They're guaranteed X number
of Vista machines shipping.
Yeah. Dell's not shipping a non-Vista machine, and Dell ships a lot of PCs.
Right. But the question is, Dell shipped a lot of PCs last year. They shipped a lot of PCs this year. They're going to probably ship a lot of PCs next year, but are those people that bought PCs the past 2 or 3 years going to buy a new PC with Vista? Or is it going to be the people that bought systems 4 or 5 years ago?
Probably two to four years ago, I guess.
So what determines the success? What is the time frame?
If it buys them time against the oncoming wave of not just Linux but Mac and everything else, it was a success. I don't think it's a dollar thing to them. I think it's a not losing too much market share too fast.
What determines the success is their marketing choice. We said this is a success, so therefore it is. Well, and we're shipping it on everything that goes out the door right now.
And perception then becomes reality.
Yeah.
I tell you what, man. Even though I don't like Apple, they are rolling, man. They are really rolling the money. They're moving. They keep opening Apple stores.
What they're doing is not a sustainable model.
They
can't sell that many iPods that long for 10 years.
No.
None of the people that would buy MP3 players.
It's a fad right now. I believe you're wrong.
You think they can increase at the rate they've been increasing long term?
Well, see, the iPod self-destructs, most of them.
Yeah, they die.
After 6 months.
I've had a couple. None of them ever.
You're the exception.
You're lucky,
mine lasted 6 months.
I kind of beat on my Nano, too. I dropped it.
Everybody, I got an iPod.
I don't use my iPod anymore.
It doesn't make any difference of whether you use them or not.
Oh, no, I do have two.
If you're buying them, that means it's a sustainable
one was a gift and one was an iPod. But I wouldn't buy...
So they're going to come out with video iPods, and they're going to come out with some other little iPod.
But at $3.99, people aren't going to buy it once a year.
They're going to increase... Yes, they are. And they're going to increase the storage capacity, and they're going to come up with little iPods that run on some kind of little optical media you can change, and they'll come up with different colored ones.
See, the problem for them, and I think they know this, and I think the rocker sucks, because Apple is very cognizant of the fact that the day a kick-ass MP3 phone comes out, the iPod dies that day. Because you carry a phone everywhere you go. If this could, like this phone conveniently plays MP3s, but I wouldn't run with this. So I still need a Nano. Because this is way too bulky. But the day they have a phone that's a normal-sized phone that doesn't suck,
and that's one of those
and
things
a built-in iPod,
I think that's in development. That's in development to come in.
But I think the rocker sucks now because they know that.
They tripled the first Razer, their first Razer. The Razer
Razer. The iTunes?
The iTunes.
Rocker.
Rocker, yeah, I'm sorry. But they crippled that one.
Yeah.
Because they weren't ready.
They were not ready to give up the iPod cash cow.
Yeah, that was purposely crippled.
But the thing that's could be unfortunate for them is what if Apple doesn't come out with the first good MP3 phone?
They screwed Motorola well, and you know how I know why?
It's totally screwed Motorola.
I bet it's already patented.
Because they need, if they're going to make a phone, they're not going to do it themselves. They're going to go to somebody else.
Oh, Apple is all about doing it themselves, though. They want it to look like an Apple product. They want it to feel like an Apple product.
Smell like an Apple product. And to die like an Apple product.
I don't think Motorola would make a phone that would make Steve Jobs happy.
Probably not.
They have a fantastic marketing machine behind that.
Oh, Steve Jobs is a genius. Between Apple and Pixar, he owns half of Disney now.
Bruce Parrish worked at Pixar.
He what?
He used to work at Pixar.
Really?
Bruce Parrish.
Yeah. Eventually he'll own Disney.
But you know, do you use your iPod for Linux?
GTK pod?
GTK pod?
That's all I use.
So then you don't purchase music through iTunes, do you?
No. I use that tool from Scratch to download the free song every once in a while.
Sharp Music? That tool?
No, the Python one.
Pi Music.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's dead. It's Sharp Music now.
Oh, I haven't used it in a while, but when I first got it, I needed to get the song
anymore.
Of the week.
It doesn't work anymore.
Oh, but that was the only time I used
it. Sharp Music still works. That's
now,
the mono bass.
Is yours a FAT32 or a HFS Plus or
FAT32? Okay.
Mine, when I used on an iPod, I was doing HFS Plus.
Yeah. Does that work in Linux?
Yeah.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it did. Until I had a catastrophic failure and lost everything. Had
did
to reprogram
it.
What?
Would you drop it or something?
No, something got corrupted on it, and I just had to reformat it and wipe it all out. And then I couldn't use my purchased music from iTunes anymore. It was terrible.
So you got raked over by Apple.
I didn't buy that. I just bought like one or two test songs.
I pretty much rip CDs or listen to podcasts. I don't really even download music.
I go to Magnitude, all the independent stuff.
Magnitude's got some good
Very
stuff.
Very cool stuff, man.
They do have some good stuff.
And MP3 Tunes is pretty good too, man.
Is that the Russian one?
No, MP3
2 is
Michael Robinson.
What is it?
The Russian one's all of it.
All of MP3.
Isn't it like they're 30 cents or something?
It's ridiculous.
It's really, really cheap.
No, it's cheaper than that. I thought it was
3 cents.
Like 2 cents.
2 cents a song?
2 to 3 cents a song.
Yeah. It's actually by megabyte, isn't it?
It falls under like a loophole in their copyright law.
It's a technicality in their copyright law.
So it's legal in Russia.
Yeah, but not here. Yeah,
so
but it's non-traceable. It's non-traceable and non-prosecutable.
It all has to do with the import-export laws. That I think there's a loophole that allows them. But if you really pushed it through court, I think it'd be tough to prove. But at the same time, it could be proven.
So the Russian guys, what they do is they pay off the judges and shit. So they don't push the case through.
In Russia.
In Russia.
But could the RIA prosecute
I think so.
Here?
I think
no,
so.
Because they have to have proof.
So they need the logs from Russia, which I'm quite sure they wouldn't.
It's not illegal to buy it in Russia and bring it here. It's illegal. I think it is
illegal.
To buy it.
It's not illegal in Russia. So if you say, I need your logs, the Russians are going
to
go, I didn't do anything illegal. Fuck yourself.
Right.
It's a gray area with the import-export law. It all has to come down to the import-export law says, if you are purchasing something for your personal use, then it's okay. It goes along like that, but it's really gray.
It's the gray area.
Yeah, it's right on the edge right there.
If there was a legitimate service that offered non-DRM music, I'd probably use it. But, I mean, iTunes is...
Well, MP3 Tunes, they had this thing called Sideblocker, and what they did was they bought a bunch of mainstream acts, like just a couple songs from each one, and what it is you can have a locker, and you can listen to the stuff streaming to you for free, but if you pay, I think it was $40 for the year, you could download the whole thing. So for $40, you could download any of those
songs. How many
songs
were in the locker?
Well, the catalog that they had of mainstream acts was about 200 songs, I think. 300 songs.
For what?
Mainstream acts are usually garbage. I mean, if it's 400 songs of Britney Spears and...
It's like, it's a mixed bag.
I wouldn't pay $4.
It was a mixed bag. There's stuff like a couple Coldplay songs, a couple Beyonce songs.
I think it's so
pretty much got the things they know everyone.
It's like top 40 type stuff.
Is that the thing that he had posted on his blog?
Yes, yes. Sideblocker.
There's a whole lot of stuff on there. I mean, like, I found some Iron Maiden, some
really?
Twisted Sister.
That's definitely not in the top 40.
No.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I don't know how they're getting away with it.
They're paying the what? What we're going to talk?
But it's a flat fee.
Well, we're going to talk to Kevin Carmody.
No, free.
Now,
the
free
thing is what he's talking about, because I can download anything on there.
You can download
anything.
I thought it was streaming.
There's an option to stream it, and there's an option to download it.
No,
so I don't know how they were getting away with that.
I don't know. We'll have to ask
even have Metallica on here. Metallica is like viciously
anti-fucking pro-DRM.
I think they're even anti-selling their music now.
We'll have to ask him to deal with that if he knows about it.
We don't even want to give it to you on CD, damn it.
We'll ask him. He probably knows. Because that's Michael Robinson. It's inspired, pretty much. Yeah, that's what that
all
is.
All over the place, then.
Yeah.
Got the SIP phone thing going, and
he's got DVG John working for him.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. A smart dude.
Smart kid, Mark.
Do you listen to the radio at all?
I'm serious.
Oh, you have serious?
Yeah.
Does anybody listen to the radio?
Not me, man. I listen to podcasts on my drives.
How often do you do you commute to work?
7 minutes.
7 hours. So when do you listen to Sirius?
All 7 minutes.
You have the portable.
Your genie's got a warmest car.
No, it's built into my car.
Buffalo, man.
Warm the car up.
That's true. A
few minutes.
I just get in and drive. I'm used to it.
7 minutes? Who cares?
You got about 2 songs in there.
Yeah, man.
Mine's built into the head unit.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's fine.
I think Alan has the one that's portable.
I had XM for a while until I found out that my car came in Sirius. That was the portable one.
What are you driving?
BMW.
Oh, right.
Mr. Moneybag.
Mr. Moneybag singles. It all changes, man. Once you get married, you have the kids, you get the mortgage, man, the money goes bye-bye.
Jeremy's going to start working for the Geek Squad soon.
Listen here, don't go around your finger, buddy. It goes around your wallet and your testicles.
Oh, yes. Go work for the Geek Squad a couple days a week. Those guys are doing something right, man. They're charging $100 an hour.
For what?
The Geek Squad.
You know who Geek Squad is? That's Best Buy.
Thank you very much. House.
Can I get another one of those?
Sure.
Thank you. You want
one? Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah, that's it. I just don't get how people pay that shit.
It's like,
if I go out and do some work for somebody, I feel guilty charging like $20 an hour.
Yeah.
And this bastard over here is charging him $60 now.
Charging $65, thank you very much.
$65.
And I feel bad about that, but you know what? When he goes somewhere else, they charge him twice.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
They charge him $100 an hour, and they don't know what they charge him $100 an hour, and they don't know what the hell they're doing. So I charge them $65 an hour, and I fix it in 20 minutes if I can. Someone else charges them $100 an hour, and it takes 4 hours to do something.
A whole new system.
Except for Windows installed. And that's it. No shit. That's what I tell people.
Yeah, I won't do that.
Come to me, they say, I want my Windows reinstalled and I need to keep all my files or something. And I'll tell them, I'll say, like, do you have the reinstalled disk? No shit. I said, do you have the reinstalled disk, the driver disks? No. I said, listen, go out and buy a new computer. They're $400. I said, I guarantee you it's going to take me longer than that. I said, just go buy a new computer. Well, what about all my files? Kiss him goodbye. I said, if you want me to do it, it's going to cost you $500 easy. You know? No, are you kidding? I said, hey. I said, I'll give you phone numbers. You know? Go anywhere you want. I said, you'll be calling me back. Yeah. Just the way it is. You can't. You know? Professional, I expect to get paid for it. And that's one thing that's ripping them off. I'm charging $40 an hour less than everybody else is. You know what I mean?
Right.
There was an article on Alexa a couple days ago. Something about Vista and the problems with Samba. Issues with the Samba, or legal issues with Samba. Nobody?
I remember reading something about that, but I can't. I don't believe for a second there's any legal issues with Samba.
I don't know how there could be. I mean, there's not seen any privileged information.
Maybe not legal issues, but performance issues, but some issues. The Samba.
They throw a wrench at the Samba so that it sucks.
I have no doubt they try.
Oh, yeah, they do.
I have no doubt.
We talked to Jeremy Allison, and they do.
I had a pretty good discussion with him in London last night.
He's a good guy. Yeah,
he's convinced that they periodically release updates to Windows to break Samba.
Would not surprise me.
Doesn't surprise me, David.
At least.
I'd bet good money that he was right, you know?
It's in their best interest, too, so.
Absolutely. But shouldn't they, man?
They've done much worse than that. That's
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Bruce Perens today was talking about how he's convinced that there's going to be some kind of giant patent war
coming up between Microsoft and open source?
Between who and open source?
Microsoft.
But and who? Open source is a concept. You can't quite...
All of it. Everything they have a patent on.
All Linux distributions are going to freaking bring up patents that they have.
They've got patents on it. Microsoft holds a patent on every fucking thing that's ever been written for a computer.
How many would be overturned for prior art?
That's the thing.
Well, but the thing is
that they're going to have this
big war. It's not so much as it being overturned or whether it's being legal or not. The point is, once they start doing that, it's going to scare people, the businesses, from wanting to actually use the software.
Well, see, I don't
and
see
then
that
the people that they target aren't going to have the funds to fight the lawsuit.
But here's the thing. Microsoft is not going to sue people. It's going to sue businesses.
Businesses, yeah. That'd be
right.
Too bad for their
will
image.
Not sue people. It's going to, that would cost them too much money.
But it would make their image too bad. Too.
Yeah. And right. You don't sue your customers. That's just all there is for. But they would sue businesses, so they would attack big Linux businesses. People like IBM,
Novell,
yep, who already have provided indemnification to their customers and will continue to do so, or they will lose their business. You know what I mean? So you're going to get immediate indemnification.
So that means they'll sue Red Hat.
IBM. Yep. Same with Red Hat.
Red Hat won't offer indemnification. They've already
well, they'll
stated.
Shut Red Hat down. Red Hat's a shit.
But see, they're not going to be stupid. They're not going to sue.
Red Hat dies, Linux dies.
Yeah, they're not going to sue.
Red Hat dies.
They do a lot of development.
No, it's nothing to do with. It's not from a technical perspective.
From a business
it's
point.
From a business perspective. Red Hat is Linux. Like it or not.
I don't
like RHEL or like RHEL.
I don't like
Red Hat. Red Hat dies, Linux dies.
I think the paradigm has shifted from Red Hat to SUSE.
Oh, wait.
No,
they're getting their asses kicked.
A lot of shops run Red Hat, man.
I know the software that I run at work on it. They will guarantee the software works only with Red Hat. And technically, only with Red Hat Enterprise 3. That's how old this one's running.
Like, I think SUSE has
more than the company.
SUSE will pick
that's
it up. Plus
there are better ones out there.
There are too many free projects associated with Red Hat.
They're
completely compatible. CentOS, Fedora.
85% of all companies would not run that.
I don't believe it.
They don't care that it's technically just as good, and they don't care that other distributions are technically much better.
I don't believe it.
They don't care.
They care for
you want Oracle, you have to buy RHEL.
Those are big companies. Well, listen, those are big companies, and the reason they choose that is because of their indemnification. Novell will provide that to them with SUSE. There's no doubt in my mind. And the other companies that don't buy that don't run Red Hat anymore. Really? The vast majority of companies that run Linux do not run Red Hat.
They run their
mom and pop shops, their small, medium sized businesses.
Yeah, but it takes a million mom and pop shops to equal one IBM.
But it's not IBM we're worried about, you know?
And even mom and pop shops, they don't want to learn Debian. They want
to
call
someone. I'm telling you, they want
tech support.
The mom and pop shops
want some company to call them. It's probably not even going to help them.
The mom and pop shops are not running Red Hat now. They want to run Debian and Slack.
They want to pay for it. They want to pay for tech support. Even though they don't ever call them, they still want it.
They want the 800 number in their pocket that they could call. And they probably never will.
They probably never will, yeah.
It doesn't matter.
So all they need to do is take out Red Hat, you say?
Linux would certainly live on. I'm not saying that.
I know what you're saying.
I'll always run Linux. You'll always run Linux.
Yes.
But from a business perspective, Novell has already proven they can't beat Microsoft. They've proven it twice. And they had superior technical products both times. They can't do it. And they're failing with Linux miserably now. Look at the numbers. They're losing more people with NetWare every day than they gain with Linux, which means in a zero-sum game, they're losing installs every day. They're getting less people to install Celeste than they're getting people to not leave NetWare. They're losing. And I think SUSE has a ton of potential. And I think when they bought SUSE, they made an awesome move. And I think SUSE is a very good product. But from a marketing and a business perspective, right now they're not in a good position. And the reason IBM likes Linux is because they've realized I will never be beholden to a Microsoft again. So they want Celeste and they want RHEL. Because that means if one messes up, the other one's always there to catch the flag. And if one dies, they're not going to like it. So if they're in a tenuous position unless a third guy pops up.
Or Ubuntu comes up or something.
And Ubuntu could be the third. I mean,
but is Novell, again, is
unless
Novell,
Ubuntu comes with a 24/7 number that they can call for text.
Doesn't
support.
Canonical have that?
Well, Ubuntu can come with a 24/7 number. That's the thing.
I think.
Oh, can it?
Okay, so
can.
Canonical has that.
You
like
can call up Canonical
company.
And get a support contract. I'm fairly certain.
I think so, too.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
But they're not certified for Oracle.
No.
They're not certified for
But see, you guys are going on the assumption that that can't happen in a flick of a fast second. Red Hat goes down,
Oracle
I'm telling you,
move
the next day, the next day, Oracle would certify Novell. They would certify SUSE.
Well, they certify SUSE.
The next day.
Plus and RHEL are your options.
You know? They would certify.
But the whole situation with Novell, regardless of whether they have switched to
because they have money invested in,
they'd still be in the same boat.
Who?
Novell.
What same boat?
If they switched to a Linux platform and continued on with NetWare, they'd still be in the same boat. Because people have been jumping off of NetWare for the past 5 years now.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you don't think that it's going to turn around?
I'm talking
for them?
About SUSE as a viable Linux product, and you're talking about Novell NetWare as a file server. Right?
But I mean,
I'm talking about Novell as a long term viable company.
It'll be around forever.
Well, I think it'll be around for a long time, but will they botch SUSE in the process? Like they botched Novell? Or like they botched NetWare?
They didn't botch NetWare.
That could have been so much more than it was.
They didn't botch NetWare because NetWare's niche is being filled in other places. That's what it amounts to.
But had they not held on to IPX so long and jumped to IP when they could have, I think the server market... Active Directory today is not as good as NDS was
seven years
ago.
You and I know that Active Directory sucks, but the average mom and pop and the average suit-wearing yuppie bastard has no idea. And they don't care.
No, they don't.
Right, they don't care. They want... Now, I have Windows here. Why can't I just hook my Windows box from here to the Windows box? They don't give a shit about file servers and security and protocols. They just want this file over there and that file over there. So that's what happened in Nevada. The only reason that they have any kind of a viable business for NetWare right now is because of their... Because of their pre-existing server installers, which just run. You know what I mean? Like, I have a 311 server sitting at work. It's still running. I never have to set the timer now. That's it.
Well, I mean, it's a scary situation because I am, with the school districts that we work with, that I come in contact with, they are all concerned about this move to Linux. And, on one hand, I'm sitting there saying, hey, you're getting the same stuff, but on a better platform. Right. And on the other hand, they have the IU saying, now's the time to jump to Microsoft.
Go to Windows.
We'll set you up with an Active Directory. We'll migrate everything over to it. It'll be great for
you. That's what my company did. The freaking desktop's going backwards.
And of course, they won't listen to you when you tell them that Microsoft breaks its own implementation every time it releases
desktops.
Right?
Yeah.
People go out, they buy a system, you have a choice, Apple or, any of the other myriad of PC distributors running Windows. So you buy that, it's like, well, why are you going to run a Novell server? Why are you going to run something? You can't find a Novell certified person that much anymore.
CNAs aren't where they used to be.
Right. I mean, you can't shake a stick without hitting an MCSE or an MCA. And, even the people that I work with now are confused about Novell. So if I leave, they're going to say, screw it, we're moving to Windows. Because they've inundated the market. It's not about quality, it's about quantity.
Marketing.
But you have
they
to
know
you have to speak
marketing.
You have to speak suit speak. You
have to tell them about the ROI.
Linux does not.
Linux does it. But in order to get it in, you have to be able to speak to it, and you have to tell them that they're, you know, that their the return on their investment is going to be greater with Linux. Because, like I said, suits don't know and they don't care.
Here's the question, and this is the fundamental question that I really do struggle with. Everyone says we want mass market adoption. That's where Linux is going. I think to get there, we will have to sacrifice what got us where we are right now. Linux now always takes the technically correct route. They don't. The marketing guys do not drive Linux right now. The tech guys do.
Yeah.
And that's why Linux totally kicks ass, is because the tech guys make the decision. So we have to decide, do we want Linux to be Linux, or do we want Linux to be Windows?
Yeah, you're right.
And there's no in-between. If it's always Linux, it will never, ever, ever be Windows. We'll never have that massive adoption.
What do you mean by that? Do we have to sacrifice choice?
Yes.
Security?
Okay. Stability?
Do you have to sacrifice security?
Stability, no. Security, to a certain extent, I think, and choice, 100%. You think my mom wants to fuck around with KDE versus GNOME? You're XFC out of your mind. But if there wasn't KDE versus GNOME, in my mind, Linux would not be what it is. I like Linux because he might want Slackware, you might want Ubuntu, I might want Fedora, you might want Arch, and we all get really what we want. If you want Linux to be where Windows is now, kiss that goodbye. So it's either going to be the 5%er like it is now, where we all get, that 5% all gets what we want, or it's going to be the 95%er where you all get shit. I don't think there's any, there's no,
if we can find
a way to fix that.
Do you think we're starting to see
a happy medium somewhere?
Do you think you
give up too much choice to get to 95%. You have to, there's too low of a common denominator.
Do we really have to have 95%?
I think no.
I think we could, if we could get it to like 30%, where it was just a viable solution.
I'd say 15
would be awesome.
Mac has 5, and everything supports Mac.
Where it was a viable solution.
Yes.
That would be fantastic.
That's where I would like it to go.
Exactly.
I agree with you. 15%.
But I don't think we have to. I do agree that we have to lose some of the stuff, and we have to innovate a bit better. But I don't, like we were talking before, I don't believe that the innovation has to come at the expense of it being Linux, and that you have to innovate towards it being Windows. I think we can innovate towards it being Linux and make Linux better.
Yeah, but
if you want your goal to be 15.
I guess the point, what you're saying there is, you don't have to make it Windows,
right?
But you have to make it one thing.
We would have to change a few things.
You can't have
and make it
QT and GTK.
You can have all of that, but you need to standardize on the initial things. You know
what are the initial things?
That's something you have to come up with.
So you're saying freedesktop.org is the way.
Something like that, where you would standardize on freedesktop.org and would set it up by default that way. Slack,
so
Twitter,
KDE
Fedora,
could implement how they want, but
the
APIs would all be.
Right. And then when I get the box and I say, well, I really don't like KDE, I'm on an XFCE. XFCE is still available for me to use the way I want to.
Right, but
you know what I mean?
I mean, that's the problem is with the choice, though.
I'm not... Well, the choice is still there.
But the problem is...
Well, if you make a default choice,
but that means
that's a smarter...
If a window manager choice wants to go in a certain direction and freedesktop.org APIs don't allow that, you lost choice. And there's no way around that.
Well,
it's choice or lowest common denominator. You can't have both.
But did we see fallout of that type, that attitude, when Nobel said, we're moving to Genoa? And kind of left the KDE issue. And there was such a huge...
Most suits of people were heavy KDE. That was a weird move. That was a weird move.
But, I mean, that's looking towards the future. It's really hard to have two separate...
I think that kind of shows Novell's fundamental misunderstanding of the market, is they bought a KDE distribution and then bought Xenia.
Yeah, which is known.
Which are diametrically opposed.
Yeah, it's known, right?
From a culture perspective, from a community perspective, from a what they think is the best OS, like desktop environment perspective, you cannot merge Xenia with KDE.
Yeah, but that's non-tech savvy people making those kind of decisions. Suits going, oh,
oh, yeah, we really like this. We're kind of getting FUSA as a package deal, but I really like this desktop that they have.
I think they like the carpet. They like the idea of what Zeemian was doing, which was a good idea.
We kind of like what they're doing over here, so let's just put them all together. And they didn't, of course, as a suits do, they never included any technical people in there to raise their hand and say, wait, you're stupid.
I know they just took one guy. That's not going to work.
But do you think getting 15% of the market is going to change anything?
I think really 5 or 7 would change.
You think that that's going to convince Adobe to port Acrobat?
Adobe runs on a Mac that has 5.
Yes, I do, because they run on a Mac at 5%.
Mac has 5%.
But what does Linux have?
On the desktop?
Right.
Two? Less than one.
One, maybe.
On the desktop?
You think so?
Yeah.
Linux has no market share on the desktop.
Yeah. We're in the vast minority.
Get 8%.
Linux is down there with like 3 DOS now. You know?
Yeah.
So you think it's going to take off overseas?
I think Asia is going to change. We're starting on an even keel with Microsoft.
But if you go over to Asia and they capture a significant portion of the market in Asia, that's going to increase the overall worldwide usage of Linux on the desktop.
Especially that's where all that we will have to compensate for that. Would that convince
the Adobes, the Mac Medias to upload?
I didn't even think about that. Right. If they do finally capture the Asian market, that's where all the hardware is made. So all hardware probably will support Linux then.
Well, it's not just that. It's that look at how many people are in Asia, right?
Hundred zillion trillion
people, right? They squirt them out faster than you can get drops of water out of the air, right? There's billions of them.
Yeah, our Asian people are going to like...
Out the nose, here it goes.
We love Asian people.
No, seriously, right? Like China. China has billions of people.
Like 6,
right? Right. That's a lot of people there. And if they standardize on a Linux operating system for their government usage...
They already have.
But they're still using it on us, right? I'm talking like really big. They're really trying to funnel people into it, right? Once that happens, then in order for the free market to work with China and to trade with them, they're going to want to be compatible to this Linux thing that they got going on. You know what I mean? So that more of those people are going to adopt that sort of a standard. And it's going to trickle out from there, from Europe down to the U.S. I think it's going to hit Europe a lot harder first than it will hit here, because we're kind of autonomous with that, and we command a lot of market power. But eventually, it's going to work its way back here. You know what I mean? Once that trickle down from Asia gets into Western Europe, okay, then we're folding right in after. And I don't think it's going to be as hard for Western Europe to fold into it as it is for America or something like that, because they already have good ideas, like they hate software patents and things like that. You know what I mean? So they already have that stepping stone here that we're lacking. But once they fold in there, we're going to have to fall behind.
Because
you can't do the software patent, but know the software patent shit and Linux in Western Europe and then follow software patents and use Microsoft.
So do you think Microsoft is dead? It's not in the short term and the long term.
You got to say who will bleed where, though. What if we bleed there first? Did you see Microsoft just asked for Bush's help in the Europe thing? So if they can kind of squeeze the patent issue over there first.
They're squeezing. It depends on who squeezes hardest. You know? Because they're revisiting the whole software patent issue.
Now, what you're saying there, and I tend to agree with what you're saying, but in speaking with Sunwa, guy today, he said that the server market is good to go. It's pretty much wrapped up.
He said
the desktop market, just like over here, I get the impression it's really hard to break into. Even over there.
Very hard, but what comes
back to application.
What did he end that conversation with, though? He said, well, it's very hard to break into the desktop stuff, except we just did all our public libraries in such and such a city in Sunwall Linux. And there's
the government.
There's the government. Yeah, and the government just changed all the desktops to Linux for such a school district, right? That's what it was.
Now that comes around, what you hear time and again is the application. And what do people want on the desktop computer? They want to be able to watch their videos, they want to be able to play their music, they want to be able to play their games. So, I mean...
You know what the Chinese are doing with the codecs, the video codecs? They're developing their own codecs.
Right, well, you got Stephen Von Nichols who said it's not going to be a problem with the video codecs. I mean, look at that side. But you got the GameX guy who said he was out there talking to developers who are all for this. They're like, this is a great idea. The stuff that you're showing us is great. We're all for this. Now you just need, he said, we just need the hardware manufacturers to buy into it.
So they're not going to pop up some respect.
But if the Asian
market... Well, they won't because they're in Microsoft's back pocket.
But if the
not
Asian
only that, though, the current Linux atmosphere... NVIDIA has provided a driver, non-free, non-GPL, but a driver that works normally. And we've pretty much told them to fuck off and die after they work. With that as the example, whether you agree with the open source paradigm or not, and I think we all do, that's not an example that another hardware manufacturer is likely to dive into.
I don't see that as being in an eventuality. Not right now.
No.
In an eventuality, I don't see that as being their choice. I think they will have to cough up the information so that we can get... They may not provide drivers, but they'll provide all the information that you need to have something going on.
As they should.
Yes.
It's your hardware.
Yes.
I mean, you
I think they will. They will cough up all the system specifications necessary, and it'll be taken care of either by a professional version of Linux, the professional Linux community, or by the open source community. Very quickly. I don't see that happening right away.
No.
But in an eventuality, they're going to. Especially because Asia is pushing very hard on this adoption of Linux over there.
That's what's going
to
do it.
And in order to do that, because everything I have on my computer is manufactured in China or Taiwan. You know what I mean? Everything in there. I can't even get a wire made in the United States anymore. You know, plastic, everything is good. So as soon as they start really pushing stuff over there, the hardware manufacturers are going to have to open their doors and go, because they can't afford to make 100 billion CD-ROMs, they can't sell to China. You know, that's a bad business for them. They won't be able to, even they might hate it. And they might have to tell Microsoft.
So what we're saying basically is that China is the future.
I think that's going to be Asia. Will be a big stepping stone.
Scary, man. When you think about it, it's a communist country, man. It's a powerful
country. But on the flip side of that, China basically says we're going to take what we want, regardless of what you think. Screw you. So if they want Microsoft products, they're going to take it.
No. See, that's the thing. They're adopting an open source. Yeah, they can, but they're not going that way. That right now, they're adopting an open source stance, right, on the stuff that they're doing. Even though they do not have to pay a red freaking penny to Microsoft.
Right.
And many times they don't.
Yeah, a lot of stuff is pirated.
It's subsidized software.
Well, I mean, it doesn't make sense for them. And with their mindset, it would make more sense for them to develop their own operating system or version. And they can't do that with Microsoft. They can do that with
Linux. Yeah, but they just pirate the Microsoft
or
stuff over there
or something and sell it. But they can't make any money. The government really can't make any money.
No, they can't. They need their own version.
So, I mean, if they develop their own system, then they can sell.
Yep.
Then they can make money off of it.
They can sell it to the rest of the world.
I don't know if they go as far as selling it to the rest of the
world. You're thinking that they're trying to make this so that they can keep a lockdown on everything, or so that they can innovate and make some money off it?
I think they're looking to make money.
I think it's I don't think it's so much as innovation as it is, you know, why are they going to take a significant portion of their infrastructure and finance that to another company, to a business outside the United States. It doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't make any sense for any corporation or any country to base their infrastructure on a corporation outside the United States. I mean, outside of their country, to fund the United States corporation. I mean, China is a great example of somebody saying, of a country saying, hey, no. We're not paying some American company so we can run our infrastructure.
We're not paying a Microsoft tax to run our computers, yeah.
So, and you might also look at that and say, well, wait a minute. You know, we got countries and we got multinational corporations. We got a concept of business crossing continental and country barrier boundaries here. You know, are we looking at a single corporation, you know, running in the United States, or are we looking at a multinational corporation? Where is the economics in all that?
Me too.
Is the concept of a country, you know, funding or looking at it from a nationalistic point of view, a dying concept?
Not yet.
I guess time will tell, right?
I mean, if you're a successful large company these days, it's really hard to have your corporation in one
country. You're a multinational.
Right. So then does that make...
But unless you're China, which is the country and the company is one and the same.
Right. But, you know, like you say, is your company an American, a United States company, or is it a multinational company? I don't know. I'm not an economic dude. Pat is.
Actually, finance.
That's the finance dude.
Oh, we're going to shut this off. I think we're done here.